Trying to find out where the feedback is coming from. Okay, found it. K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You will also be hearing Mel, Kilo 2, Kilo Echo Yankee. Mel and Dick attempt to organize this very enthusiastic crew that meets in the New York City area for the last 28 years, most Sunday evenings. And nowadays, we stretch it to 4 hours. It used to be 1 hour in the very beginning. We try to make connections between the brain power that exists in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area, the tri-state area that this particular repeater covers. We try to make connections between those people who have got some knowledge and people who have got questions. It's my belief that inside of every true ham radio operator, there's a scientist that would like to get out. And to really work in the field of science, quite often it requires a PhD degree and an assignment from a place like Brookhaven Laboratory. And not every one of us can do that. But as backyard experimenters and experimenters on our towers and our basements, we fulfill a little bit of that need. Ham radio supplies that. And for the people who are learning the art and craft of ham radio, let me drop. Electronics in general, particularly wireless electronics, has a large list of things that you really would like to understand in order to know how it works, how to make it work better, how to explain some of the crazy things you see happening from time to time. Band openings, for instance, or sunspot cycle relationships, and why does my transmitter do that? So lots and lots of questions as people are learning the art and science, and therefore they come together to this particular repeater, they express their questions on Sunday evenings, and a good percentage of the time, somebody has got some knowledge in one of those areas and tells us the benefit of his knowledge and his experience. That's sort of what we do. A person signs into the technical net by giving Dick and Mel your call letters, your name. Try to remember to give me your name. And give me your call letters phonetically if you've never signed in before. And the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment to the net. You need not sign in just to let us know you're listening. That's not required. After 28 years, we sort of believe that. That doesn't have to be confirmed to us anymore. A long list of people just signing in saying they're listening doesn't serve any purpose here. A person signing in would sound like this, KC2RFN, Alan, and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes right now, K2RIW.
WA2, Lima, Kilo, Juliet, Dave, yes.
Well done, Dave. That's exactly the way people should sign in. Lima, Kilo, and Juliet, Dave. He's number one. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
KC2, Tango Zulu Golf, Joe from Brooklyn, Gravesend, yes.
Well done, Joe. Okay, we got Dave and Joe. Anyone else to sign in? Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW listening.
WS2N, Paul, yes, with a question, I think.
Good evening, K2KEY to all.
Okay, we got Paul and Mel, and Paul with a real question, and when we get to you, Paul, will there be a space report tonight? Has NASA been doing anything we should hear about? WS2N for a quick break on that one.
No, I didn't notice anything new for this week, but we'll be available for questions or topics if something comes up, or if you think of something, Dick. Back to you.
Good to know, Paul. Thank you. Okay. We'll put out another call. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes at this time. And we'll wait long enough in case there's somebody out of the area that wants to check in. K2RIW listening.
Whiskey Alpha 2, Radio Yankee Yankee. Yo. Yes.
Okay, we got Joe. Anyone else? One last call. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WB2RWZ, name is Len. No.
C2ZQJ, Dave. No.
Okay, we got Len and Dave. This is the so-called new technical net, in which we make a sincere effort to try to answer everyone's question at least briefly during the first hour. That means no one has to wait longer than an hour to get at least a brief answer. Dave was our first check-in, WA2 Lima Kilo Juliet. Go right ahead, Dave. We're listening for your question.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening to the net. My question is, I'm trying to open up some 3.5-inch discs that were written on a Macintosh around circa 1990, probably in Mac Word. I have been unable to open them, and I do not have an old enough Mac. I've also Googled it, and it was no help. Does anybody have any suggestions?
Yeah, I'm hoping that somebody with computer smarts can answer that particular question. And I was wishing my son was also available. He runs a free computer network that's on the radio station for Stony Brook University on, what is it now, Saturday nights, I think it is, where questions like that get answered. So can anyone answer Dave's question? If you've got any knowledge at all on these older formats, how can Dave read that particular file? Give me a call, let us right now if you've got any kind of a suggestion, or even if you know of somebody who might have a suggestion, give us your call, let us right now, K2RIW. Yeah, that's a little bit discouraging. And looks like Dave's going to get the prize of the night. He stumped us. there is a computer net that meets on this repeater. I believe it's on a Wednesday night, and I think it's the second or third Wednesday of the month. Does anyone know when the computer net meets? There's a little bit better chance that Dave will get an answer there. If you know when the computer net meets, hour and day, please give me your call letters right now.
Third and fourth Wednesday of the month, 8:30.
Okay, there was a double, but John won. I think you said Thursday. Repeat that one, John, and take it slowly.
Third and fourth Wednesday of the month, 8:30.
Okay, third and fourth Wednesday of the month, which means we haven't used up the third and fourth Wednesday of this month. On Thursday, 8:30, is the computer net on this repeater. So that's one lead we've got for you. One last call. Dave's trying to take an older disc, bring it up to date. He can't even find a machine that'll read the older disc. If anyone's got a suggestion, give me a call that is right now.
It's Wednesday, Dick, not Thursday.
Glad you corrected me. Second and third Wednesday of the month. Okay. Anyone else have any other suggestions for Dave? Give me a call letters right now.
PC2SYL. The name is Bill in Whitestone.
Okay, Bill. I hope you've got some kind of an answer because Dave has got us stumped here. And we don't like having these good electronic questions that we can't answer. You've got it, Bill.
Thank you, Dick, and good evening to the net. Suggestion, if you look up, if you have access to a computer, look up Apple Store. I know there is one in Manhattan, and I believe there is one in Roosevelt Field. You may want to give them a call and talk to one of the technicians there or one of the associates. They may be able to help you, and possibly if you bring the diskette there, they may be able to read it for you. Just a suggestion. This is KC2SYL.
Awful glad you signed in, Bill. And sounds like a good way to go. And one last call. Anyone else with a suggestion for how Dave can read an older disc? Give me your call letters.
KB1, Victor, Delta, Bravo.
Kilo, Bravo 1. Victor, Delta, Bravo. Start with your name, sir, and then your suggestion.
Thanks, Dick. This is Lewis from Williamsburg. I have in the past used Linux to access outdated file system types. I'm not exactly sure what that floppy disk file system type is, or you know how old it is, or if it has any physical problems that can't be read. But Linux has a huge amount of file system drivers that, you know, if you have access to a Linux system with a 3.5-inch drive, you can likely get the data off that, as well as also good for getting data off hard drives that have partially failed. So if you know someone with a Linux system and that size drive, even if it's a PC, it might be able to read the data off of it.
Good sounding suggestion, Lewis. So I think you're saying Dave must find a Linux expert. If a person doesn't have Linux already installed in his machine and doesn't have familiarity with it, just simply going to a website telling us information about Linux would probably be a pretty long task to get to the specific of what he needs. Is that approximately what we're saying here, Lewis? Go ahead.
For the most part, yes. If you don't know anything about it, it would probably not make time sense to learn about it to be able to do that. It's better to find someone who knows. There are live Linux distributions that you can like burn to a CD and boot up your computer into a Linux environment, but at that point, you still need to install the very specific sort of historic Mac file system driver that would be able to read that disk. So you still need extra knowledge, even though you can do it pretty simply these days.
This is JXN.
Okay, I think I heard JXN. Give me the full call and your name and then your comment, sir.
Okay, KB2JXM, and this is Gary.
Sounds like Juliet X-Ray Mike. Go right ahead, Gary.
Thank you. You're talking about Linux right now. Is anybody familiar with this Ubuntu?
Ubuntu, I think, is one of the many kinds of Linux. Now, one of the things I'm going to tell both Gary and Dave is there is something my son was a member of for quite a period of time while he was living on Long Island called LILUG, L-I-L-U-G, Long Island Linux Users Group. And they still have meetings, I don't know how often, I don't know when, at the university in Farmingdale. I guess it's can't even think of what we call it now. In New York State University in Farmingdale, Long Island Linux Users Group. Guarantee there's a number of experts there. There's also the Mid-Hudson Valley Linux Group. There's quite a number of Linux groups where guys with this particular bent and expertise get together and discuss all of the fine details. I'd like to believe that there is a website. If we just look up LILUG, Long Island Linux Users Group, there's probably a website that will give you lots of information. And if you have any further suggestions along these lines, give me your call letters right now. Yeah, because I'm, as you can tell, Dave, kind of light on computers. Lucky for me, my son sets up all these machines in the house that do all the work that I've got to do. I claim to be an RF maven. So I think it's about the best we're going to be able to do for you tonight. However, if you're not satisfied, you're welcome to come back next week and ask the question again. Ask the question enough times, you're eventually going to get the answer you're looking for, Dave. W-A-2, Lima, Kilo, Juliet, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, W-A-2-L-K-K. Okay, thank you for the suggestion. I did go to the Apple store a couple weeks ago. They wouldn't give me any assistance. They wouldn't even take a look at the disk. But the Linux is an excellent idea. I believe I know somebody who can help me out. And, Vic, I thank you and the net and the gentleman that gave me the information. WA2LKJ will be clear and listening.
Yeah, in case you want to know who the hero was with the Linux suggestion, that was Kilo Bravo. Kilo Bravo 1, Victor Delta Bravo. And, I guess Connecticut. That was Lewis. Excuse me a minute. Okay, the next person who signed in was Joe. Kilo Charlie 2, Tango Zulu Golf. What would you like to discuss tonight, Joe? K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Yes, how are you, Dick? Leaving time. I have the ASU. I just purchased the ASU, the FT857D. HF, VHF, and UHF. I do have a dual band antenna hooked up to the radio currently, but my question is, what would be the best antenna for me receiving on HF without any distraction with the car, noise blanketing or anything. Some people tell me a motor mount, an antenna that has to be specially bracketed to the car, where welded and everything. I just want to know, what would be the best HF antenna for this radio?
Hey, you make it sound like you want the best antenna for the radio, but I sense that this is a mobile installation, not a home installation. And as such, I know that a number of people were very happy with the screwdriver antenna. I think there's a commercial product with that name, and there's also a set of plans by which you can homebrew a so-called screwdriver antenna. It's an antenna that's got the motor out of the screwdriver in the bottom of it, which allows you to remotely tune the tuning coil so you can hit each one of the bands. So people are quite happy with that, but I'm not an HF person. Mel is, K2KEY. I'm going to be passing it over to him for some suggestions. And I bet you there are other people listening who have done high-frequency mobile installations, and they've got their favorite antenna. So if you've got a favorite antenna, give me a call that is right now for mobile service on HF, K2RIW, and the TechNet. See what Mel's got to say. That group of guys called the Kings County Radio Club, what they've done from time to time, Joe, is to hold these shootouts at Floyd Bennett Field, where they test various antennas on their mobiles and really find out what the performance is. So I wonder if you've got a suggestion, Mel, as to the results of those tests that Kings County Radio Club has run. What would you suggest for Joe? K2KEY, K2RIW and the Tech Man.
A6DPC with a comment.
W2WW with a comment.
Okay, we heard both Hal and WW, but I'm going to go to Mel first. K2KEY, go ahead, Mel.
Okay, well, in the past, some years ago, we did test the number of antennas that have to have what is considered a fairly decent mobile setup. And I had told them about my experience operating mobiles for many, many years, going way back to the late 50s. And traveling quite a bit. And the number of mobile antennas that I was able to test was whatever I could borrow, put it on my mount, which is on the old-fashioned big spring mount on top of the deck, back deck of the of my Chevy, and try different antennas. And by every method I've tried, the best one that seems to always have come out as the number one mobile antenna, again, this is my test, was the Hustler system. The only thing, of course, the Hustler, you got to change bands, you got to change coils, but it seems to be the antenna that performed the best of all the mobile antennas. Go ahead, Dick.
Sounds awful good, Mel. Give us a rough number of dollars and a model number of Hustler that you like.
Okay, well, my Hustler antenna is quite old by now. It was originally, because I was running high power in the mobile, it was the only antenna at the time that was mobile that was really rated for handling a kilowatt. And what the heck did I call it? I can't recall the model numbers of it offhand, but it was known, it's a solid pipe. It's not, a whip type of antenna. It's a solid type design. And it folds over, but it has been around quite a number of years, Dick, over.
Okay, I thank you, Mel. Hal, K6DPZ. For a new guy with a brand new FT-857D, what would you recommend for his mobile? You got it, Hal.
Right, for the beep. Okay, Dick. Well, I've been doing mobiles for the last 40 years or better, and from my experience, a center-loaded antenna with a high-Q coil is the best for mobile. And I've used Astor Mobile center-loaded antennas. I've made my own center-loaded antennas with information from the handbook, which are not hard to wind for separate bands. I use the Swan, which is a center-loaded antenna. I use one now, as a matter of fact. And that's a band switching by just shorting out the inductance. And the whole trick with mobile antenna is being that the base impedance is very low, you have to match the base impedance to 50 ohms. Then you get the maximum power transfer into a center-loaded antenna. And the way I do it is I use an AH4, a random wire tuner, at the base of the antenna to match the base impedance. And I've worked the world with this system on all bands. That's my comment, Dick.
Is there a particular model number, brand name that you like? If, on the assumption that Joe maybe is not willing to homebrew yet, maybe he wants to buy one to make the problem go away and homebrew a little bit later, is there a particular model number other than Swan, a Swan particular model number that you like, and roughly how many dollars? Over to you, Hal.
Okay, Dick. Well, I'll tell you, the new antennas out there today, none of them are really that great as center-loaded antennas. The only one I can think of off the top that somewhat comes close is, I can't even think of the name right now, but there's one that's a rotary antenna that matches, but you still have to match the base of it. The main thing is to get the most physical size of the antenna height-wise and have a center-loaded coil. Best thing is just go in the ARRL QST, and there's advertising of, I can't remember the name at this moment, Dick. Maybe somebody else could mention it. But center loaded is the way to go. Overall height should be at least 107 inches, 108 inches, the same size as CB whip. So the center loaded coil. Go ahead, Dick, pick it up.
Yeah, when it comes to the blankness of mind, I run into it at least twice during the TechNet, Hal. Thank goodness you're not over 40 where you run into that problem. You'll think of it later. Come back and tell us. Mr. WW, give me the full call letters and your name and proceed with your information. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, it's WW2WW. Name is Tim. Just a very avid mobile HF chaser. What I would say about HF is very simply this. It really depends upon what bands you want to use. I have found the last two gentlemen, Hal and your other buddy over there, mentioned very good points, and I do like the Hustler resonators too. Have lots of success with the ham sticks as well. Now, when you go on 10 meters, you could just use a whip without a coil, and you can get it to work real well, 6 and 10, and even 15. I've seen guys run quarter waves. When you start getting into lower frequencies, you get into other problems with, like, bandwidth of the antenna, and, of course, the size of the coil. And those Hustler resonators, they get rather large at 75 meters, pretty effective at 20 meters with about a 500 kc bandwidth. And then, of course, as you get lower or higher in frequency, you get a little bit more bandwidth out of those antennas. If you're looking for a single antenna that's going to work on a multiple of bands, you have to look into antennas like the Texas Bug Catcher, where you tap the coils at different areas to make up for the impedance on a capacitively loaded antenna. So you get more capacitively loaded as you get lower because of the smaller antenna, which takes a bigger induction in it with the coil to, of course, have your resonant frequency of an inductance and capacitance equalized. So really, it's really what bands you're working, and then, of course, you could decide about what type of antenna. But if you're looking for multiple, I would say something like the screwdriver or Texas Bug Catcher is going to do most of the bands without getting out there and doing a lot of switching. WW2WW.
Very fine, Jim. Sounds like you also like the screwdriver. I've heard some awful good things about that one. And the Texas Bug Catcher. And those lower bands look like you want to avoid the so-called quarter wave antennas in the lower bands, which depend on the capacitance of the automobile acting like the ground plane, and center loading and top loading. These other techniques are the way to go. In the case of 15 and 10 meters, where a simple whip will work, as the sunspot cycle goes up and the 10-meter band opens up a little bit more frequently, that band's going to become more important, even occasionally 6 meters. Anybody with any last comments for Joe on suggestions for a HF mobile antenna. Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW and TechNet.
Excuse me 1 minute, Dick, when you have a chance.
Somebody said, Dick, when you've got a minute, give me a chance. If it's on this particular subject of the HF antenna suggestion, go right ahead right now.
Yes, Dick, it's me, Joe, KC2TZG. I just also wanted to know, I know everybody's given me great advice and everything, and I'm writing everything down. Also, I'd like to know is I have a caravan. And what would be the best location, if it would be in the center of the roof, or would it be on the driver's side of the oncoming traffic?
It's not a metal roof.
Yeah, it looks like the caravan is not a metal roof, and I think you're better off finding substantial chunks of metal, like the bumper, if there is one nowadays, I guess bumpers are all plastic, but the frame of the car or the sheet metal of the car somewhere. Anybody with suggestions for a caravan, the proper location, give me a call letters right now.
N2STU.
N2STU, go right ahead. I should know your call letters, I mean your name, go ahead. Yeah, I think I hear what you're getting at here, Joe. First of all, for the antenna to work well, you'd like the base of the antenna to be connected to some substantial portion of the car, the frame, the bumper, whatever is real metal, not plastic. That's as far as the RF performance is concerned. When it comes to feeding the 12 volts to the radio, and this is a subject we've discussed a number of times on the TechNet, it is extremely tempting to run one big heavy 12-volt lead from the battery over to the radio and then ground the radio to whatever sheet metal is nearby. Do not do that as far as the 12-volt wiring is concerned. Lots of people have tried that, and they've run into all kinds of problems with creating funny glitches with the computers in the car. You got lots of computers in the car these days. I strongly recommend you run a twisted pair of heavy gauge red and black wire from your radio all the way back through the firewall, all the way back directly to the battery, with a fuse on the negative lead and a fuse on the positive lead. Both leads, a fuse right at the battery. There's a bunch of reasons for doing it. The battery is the biggest filter capacitor you've got. Let me drop. And that battery does an excellent job of removing the alternator wind. Your cigarette lighter almost never has enough current capacity. And with the twisted pair of 12-volt wires from your radio all the way back to the battery, that becomes an automatic shielded structure, which gives very little of the RF radiation into the computers, which could disturb your instrument panel, your emission control computer. There are guys who violate these suggestions, and they run into problems where the engine stalls when they key the rig, if you know what I mean. It disturbs the computer that much. So don't use B-plus grounding locally. Make that the separate wiring going right back to the battery. The only real grounding radio-wise is for the base of the antenna to hit some substantial metal at the car. I wonder if that makes some sense to you, Joe. And if need be, we can explain why you've got to put a fuse even on the negative lead, the black lead, going back to the battery. See if that all made some sense to you, Joe. KC2 Tango Zulu Golf, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2IRW, KC2TZG. I'm an electrician studying to be an electrical engineer. I understand the part where you said with the grounding of the fuse and also the positive side of the battery. I also have two marine batteries in the back of my car and an additional one in the front at 100 hours. And I ran them directly to the battery, like you suggested. And also I have a capacitor to keep it from fluctuating from 13.8 volts, and when you key up on a 50-watt radio, it usually drops down about 8 volts or about 6 volts, actually 2 volts, anywhere from 2 to 8 volts it usually drops down. So I put this capacitor in that keeps the voltage the same, and the amperage I built up a little bit more, which keeps it idled a little bit better. I was just wondering more about the ground situation with the antenna and the radio itself. So if I ground out the chassis of the radio when I mount the bracket to this radio, and I put an extra grounding lug on it, and I ground it to the chassis of the car, and I ground it to the battery, that's also good. Besides the antenna, I know I'm asking too many questions. Besides the antenna, if I make from the mount that I'm going to make from the chassis to the antenna, from that point, if I ground it, I reground it to the chassis of the car, and I ground it to the battery, would that be okay?
You're now into a area that you're going to have to do some experimenting, as I see it, Joe. The strongest recommendation we've had for now is twist a pair all the way back to the battery for plus and minus 12 volts that goes to the rig, and good grounding at the base of the antenna. If you do extra grounding to the chassis from the chassis of the radio itself locally, there are people who like doing that. There are people who do not like doing that. You're going to have to do an experiment to find out which works the best in your particular situation. The people who sometimes do extra grounding on the chassis of the radio to the chassis of the car where the radio is lawfully mounted. Sometimes that launches RF currents into the wiring for the computer and gives grief. So you're going to have to do an experiment on that one. There's no simple answer on that one as I see it, Joe. Good luck with that installation. Come back and let us know how it works, even if it doesn't work. So let us know. The next person on the list was Paul, WS2N. Paul, what would you like to discuss tonight? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. Yeah, interested in the topic of filters. Now, I know filters are a topic in themselves. You've mentioned that people spend their life studying the filters on radios and all of that, but I'm interested in the roofing filters. You know, when they advertise roofing filters, you look through all the QST books and the different radios. Oh, they tend to make a, you know, bragging point. So we have this filter, or we have three filters, or, you know, one of them says they have a 300 hertz, a 600 hertz, a 3 kilohertz. I'm just not familiar with these roofing filters. I'm more familiar with the IF filters, how they work with the digital signal processing, and, the clarifiers on the AZU, and really the RIT. I follow all of that, but when they talk about the roofing filters, let me drop it. I'm not really sure, you know, exactly what they are, or, you know, why they, you know, are they in all radios, and is it like the clarifier, you know, with the AZU, is it just a different name, do all the radios have them, and if they don't, why not, and what would you expect to hear if you didn't have them, you know, maybe a topic on roofing filters. I looked them up, I tried to find something on it in the handbook, ARR handbook for 91 and 2000, that's almost 10 years apart, and neither one of those books had anything I could find on the word roofing filters. All kinds of filter stories, but nothing about roofing. So I wonder, you know, if you have an overview of these things, you know, when were they invented, or why were they invented, or something of that nature. Back to you, Dick, WS2N.
Yeah, I think I know what you're looking for, Paul. In the normal superheterodyne process of designing a radio, you've got an RF amplifier up front which has a general filter, hopefully passing a band of RF frequencies, but because the RF front end is at a pretty high frequency, you don't get a great deal of filtering. The whole idea of the superheterodyne is that after you go through the mixer, you mix down to the first IF frequency. In general, the first IF frequency is one-tenth of the RF frequency. If, for instance, you were listening to 7 megacycle band, the 40 meter band, quite often a rig will convert down to 1.5 megacycles or something like that for the first IF, a much lower frequency. And in some cases, there's a second conversion. You convert down to lower frequencies because you can get sharper filtering at lower frequencies. Gain comes easier because some of the gain is at RF frequencies, some of the gain is at IF frequencies, but they're all on a different frequency. Therefore, you get a kind of isolation. You don't get feedback and oscillation within the radio because those frequencies are different. Okay, so for the average radio, the real filtering takes place in the final stages of the IF amplifier, particularly if it's a second conversion radio. The 455KC or 60KC might be your final IF, and that's where the serious filtering takes place. But there's a problem. And the problem is, let me drop. When you're operating in the heat of battle, of a really heavy contest, and you've got a whole lot of high power stations really nearby, you might have a kilowatt down the block, and that guy is operating 10 kilohertz up the band from you. And although your final filtering of your final IF stage has more than enough selectivity to get rid of him in the final stage, because the earlier stages of the first IF and the beginning of the IF amplifier don't yet have enough filtering, some of the earlier stages can be overloaded. So the word roofing filter really is a kind of high-quality filter pushed as far forward in the receiver chain as you can get it. I don't believe they do it into the RF amplifier. I believe it's the very first IF stage after the mixer where they put in this extremely high-quality filter. Now, for a filter to have very sharp selectivity, very deep skirts, and no re-entrance frequencies, you know, 10 kc away where it starts coming back into response again, real high-quality filters don't do that. So you want that filter to have low insertion loss, real sharp skirts. You'd like it to be what they call a brick wall filter, and you'd like to shove it as far forward as possible, because the less number of stages that exist before you get the sharp filtering, and then all the later stages after this very sharp filter are protected, and therefore you can operate with a real close signal, real strong, and the dynamic, the close-in dynamic range starts getting real good. That's my understanding of roofing filter, and I bet you there are other people on frequency that got even better standing, better understanding. They're going to give us their call letters right now. Give me your call letters if you have smarts on roofing filters. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, K2KEY.
Well recognized. Anyone else? I'll bet you you've taken something like a Collins rig, which was pretty good, and then did a redesign and put a roofing filter up front, nearer the front end of that receiver, and made great improvements. I'll bet you you've done experiments like that, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Here, in actuality, roofing filters, like you say, is a more modern name for, actually, a roofing filter and other, basically, they actually refer to it as roofing filters and other analog filters. And, of course, the roofing filter is usually selected by the bandwidth of the IF, the early IF. So in fact, usually the roofing filter, you would like to get it up as close to the front end as possible. And so what will happen is that the image rejection, we're going into based on the low IF. In other words, many of these, like you say, super heterodyne, we got double conversion. I don't know if we should get into that, but you want the roofing filters in the first conversion or in the lowers of the IF. And actually, a roofing filter, again, is a type of analog filter. I don't know if we should go any further in dealing with the local oscillator, et cetera, involving the roofing filters, Dick, over.
KC2QIQ. Glenn recognized. Part of what's going on here is that the whole purpose of the roofing filter is to increase the close-in dynamic range. Nearby, very strong signals. You don't want them to blank your receiver and make it behave crazy. So an extremely high-quality filter, as far forward as you can get, as close to the antenna, so to speak, as you can get, is the whole purpose. And I believe the vast majority of the time the roofing filter is a passive analog filter, crystal-type filter or quartz resonator or these mechanical filters. The idea of making a roofing filter out of digital signal processing, I won't say it's impossible, but because every dynamic signal, every digital signal processing technique uses first an analog to digital converter, then a fancy digital program, and then convert it back into analog. The analog to digital converter itself has got some nasty high dynamic range, wraparound, distortion-like characteristics. So I believe the better roofing filters are purely passive devices, or at least not digital signal processing. Your rig may have digital signal processing downrange to get selective nulling and tone rejections and whatever. But the roofing filter, I don't think, and here maybe Glenn's going to correct me, I don't think the roofing filter is often a digital signal processing type filter. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the DECnet. You've got it, Glenn.
Classically two-pole.
How about that? Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, good evening, Vic. Good evening, Mel, and everybody on the net tonight. I have an FTDX 9000 that has roofing filters inside of it, and they are FFT digital filters. And on the 9000, they give you a choice of filters, and my radio fortunately has both. I have the Mu tuning filters that are adjustable, and I also have the roofing filters. And basically, the controls in front of the radio give you an adjustable notch, and it just noise reduction and a contour. And basically, what you can do is when you put on your center frequency, you can contour with this roofing filter the total amount of bandwidth and the skirts on both sides, and then also control the notch. So it gives you quite a bit of adjustable filtering on a specific frequency. And like you said, when you get into really heavy-duty contesting situations, and there's some stations that are nearby, it really gives you quite an advantage to tailor the response of the receiver. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Yeah, let me pass you a quick one on that one, Glenn. Have you had a strong guy nearby, like maybe somebody is running a kilowatt, he's 1 mile away from you, and he's 10 KC up the band? By way of your selectable notch, I wonder if you have, say, for instance, maybe used a pan adapter, seen on the screen that that guy's up there 10 KC higher, blasting away, giving you a lot of grief, and you've selectively tuned a notch with your adaptable filter network of your particular receiver, and therefore drastically lowered the grief he was causing. I wonder if you've done something like that. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. And it's beautiful. And sometimes it's not the guy up the block that's a problem. Many times I'll have a very, very strong station in, like on 20 meters in, like, New Jersey, or somebody up in Connecticut or New Hampshire, and they're just a few KC away, you know, and next thing you know, they're letting loose a CQ, and you're trying to hold a nice DX conversation. And being able to swing the beam a little bit and then going into those roofing filters and adjusting the contour and notches, I can generally, you know, remove a lot of that that problem, because the station I might be talking to has no clue that that I'm getting this interference on my end. And with the 9000, I can really dial it right out, Dick. It's a beautiful thing. K4IW, KC2, QIQ.
Yeah, K2, KY, one more comment, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, Mel. And Mel, I'm going to ask you to make a guess. What percentage of the roofing filters that we can buy today are digital signal processing type as opposed to purely analog? I'm amazed that, although I guess I shouldn't be, modern-day analog-to-digital converters where they've got 10, 12, 14, 16 bits, maybe now they've got enough dynamic range, they don't run into strong signal wraparound problems. But in the past, it is my belief that the majority of good roofing filters were more passive than the DSP type. K2KEY, K2RIW.
KC2QIQ with one more comment.
Mel first, and then we'll go to Glenn. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, as you said, yeah, because I built, there was a very interesting article that was presented in QAX about building an experimental DSP system that you have basically open architecture on it, so you can make all kinds of a wireless DSP combination. And it's basically based on what is known as the 16-bit, as you say, the 16-bit Sigma Delta ADC system, and is amazed at what, you know, you can accomplish by DSP. However, if we look at the basic design, I've been asked this question a number of times, so I basically will maybe clarify it, because otherwise I'll get a lot of people asking me. Let me let it drop, and I'll say a few words about, you know, generally what you see now in the more modern equipment. Okay, let's start, because of the confusion, let's start right at the signal at the antenna. Usually a signal at the antenna will go through a low-pass filtered to remove any first mixing image responses. And then we'll go to limit also the local oscillator leakage. This is basically what the filters and what is done in the front end. In other words, you want to be able to clean things up as much as in the front end as beginning. Then we actually go through a mixing system at the first IF and through the first IF to really dodge as many spurious responses that possibly may creep in, you know. So 6 to 8 poles of crystal bandpass filtering is not unusual to hear, and we'll be in that strip, in that IF strip. I mean, this is basically what you see in the traditional IF systems being used with DSP and combining with the analog filters. Stick over.
Very fine, Mel. And we've used the word tonight, dynamic range. After we pick up Glenn's comments, I'm going to give a couple of comments as to a definition of what is the various kinds of instantaneous or overall dynamic range. KC2QIQ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention from, you know, the FTDX9000 MP that I have. I have the manual open here in a PDF file. And the way they describe it is a triple conversion type of filter, and it's called the Yaesu Custom Design 32-bit Floating Point IF DSP. And that basically is what's giving this roofing function. Now, many of the other receivers that I've had have had the fixed filters, you know, it's the crystal-type filters. I've never seen any documents ever referring to them as a roofing filter. In other words, they're usually like your IF, like you got the real narrow one setting, like on my R7, the Drake. Like I'll have a position for like a 300 hertz filter, it's a fixed position crystal, or, you know, the 500, 1.8, 2.3, and 6 kilohertz per AM. And those are fixed position filters, so either you like it or you got what you've got, that's it. With the 32-bit floating point, you know, IF DSP, these are very, very variable controls right on the front of the radio. And one of them is called the contour. You have a noise reduction, and then your notch, which is all adjustable. And then also there's a shift and bandwidth control. So in other words, you can control the overall bandwidth and shift in between. So you can create kind of like an offset type of a performance. So it's very, very adjustable, Dick, this roofing filter arrangement. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Now, you said something that's got me going here. I've heard of analog-to-digital filters, analog-to-digital converters of 8, 10, 12, 14, 16 bits, and you said 32 bits. That implies 2 to the 32 power as to the overall dynamic range of that one analog to digital converter if it was only converting one particular bit stream. Maybe it's a pair of 16 bits. 16 bits of I and 16 bits of Q. Maybe that's what's really going on here. I should have realized that. Because 32 bits would be, in theory, a 4 billion to 1 power ratio, whereas 16 bits is a hell of a lot more reasonable. So that must be 16 bits of I and 16 bits of Q. That's my guess. What do you think, Glenn? Go ahead.
Well, I'll give you the definition right here out of the manual. It's called the Yaesu Custom Design 32-Bit Floating Point IF DSP. The new IF DSP system utilizes a TI-TM320C6711 device. It's a high-speed 32-bit floating-point circuit designed with a unique objective, to do away with the digital sound that many DSP filter systems and emulates the analog sound so familiar and comfortable to the HFDX and contest operators. The result is a leading-edge receiver that has the feel of a traditional analog receiver, but with the flexibility and superb filtering capability of a modern digital filtering system. For what it's worth, Dick, that's what the manual says. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I'm still of the belief that the 32 bits is 16 of I and 16 of Q. In phase and quadrature is what I and Q means. And the digital signal processor does have to have in phase and quadrature to really do its processing. And 16 bits is a 65,000 to 1 ratio. That's 96 decibels of dynamic range. Whereas if it really was 32 bits of one single data stream, that would be 192 or 193 decibels, a 4 billion to 1 power ratio. That I don't believe. Just the hum and hiss and whatever a radio would never be low enough to give you that much digitizable signal left over, if you know what I mean. So I'm convinced when you study the schematic a little bit further, even though they use fancy words to describe it, let me drop it.
I can give you some more wording here, Dick, that might explain it a little bit better.
I can't believe 4 billion to 1 is what it is digitizing. 65,000 to 1, that I will believe. Over to you, Glenn.
Well, they call it out here as the first IF 3 kilohertz roofing filter. It's at 40 megahertz. The first IF has three adjustable, selectable roofing settings. 3 kilohertz, 6 kilohertz, and 15 kilohertz. Then you have the contour filter, the analog feeling of the DSP filters. With those are basically the ultra-sharp ones used to roll and peak off the IF response. And then there's what they call the sloped AGC circuitry, which is hooked into it. It has an AF limiter, and what's the other? Oh. Then it also has a pre-selector, which is the variable RF filter. So it's basically, there's a whole lot of, you know, filtering functions going on here in these three controls in the front of the radio. And that's not even the mute tuning, which is the optional input that goes in there to kind of like take care of the real front end of the filter. It's an amazing receiver, Dick. But I really can't respond. It doesn't go into enough detail of how they break up the bits in different parts of the filter. Maybe if I read a little bit further down, I'll come back to you on that one later. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Maybe I can clear it up, Dick.
Okay. As I, Mel recognized, as I said, I'm going to give a couple of words on what the word dynamic range really means. If I had the world's most perfect signal generator into my receiver, and I tuned the receiver to, let me pick a number, the 40-meter band, 7.1 megacycles, and I'm in the sideband mode, 7.2 megacycles, and I start plugging in a signal from the signal generator, and I start measuring how strong a signal gives me MDS, minimum discernible signal. That's one definition. And minimum discernible signal might be where the single sideband audio has, let me pick a number, either 3 or 6 or 10 decibels of audio signal-to-noise ratio. I might define that as minimum discernible signal. And then, whether or not the signal is on frequency or 3 KC higher, 10 KC higher, 20 KC higher, I can start cranking in very strong local signals. At the same time, I'm listening to a weak signal on channel. And as the stronger signal, let me pick a number, 20 kilohertz higher in the band, as the stronger signal gets strong enough, it's eventually going to create overload somewhere in the receiver. RF amplifier, first IF amplifier, the roofing filter circuitry or whatever. And eventually, as the 20 KC higher signal up the band gets strong enough from a second signal generator during this lab test, I eventually get some amount of distortion, desensitization, spurious response, something undesirable happens to the receiver. So the off-channel strong signal, survivable dynamic range, or even if the signal is on-channel, many a receiver, particularly a sideband receiver, anything that's amplitude sensitive, let me drop. Every amplitude sensitive signal, even on channel, if the signal gets strong enough, the receiver runs out of automatic gain control range, the first amplifier starts saturating, the second amplifier starts saturating, the mixer starts saturating, the local oscillator doesn't behave correctly, the power supply starts doing something funny. All kinds of funny things can happen with an amplitude reading receiver, sideband or AM, and eventually there's a level of signal in which you're now starting to get some kind of distortion. The good news is that FM tends not to do that. It's an amazing thing that you can take an FM transmitter that's in the shack with you, and you take a second receiver, maybe it's a handy talkie with earphones or whatever, a second receiver in the shack will allow you to hear the quality of what you are transmitting on the first transmitter. You try doing that with a sideband receiver, and because from your own shack, your own transmitter is so strong that your second receiver will not give you a clear indication of what kind of sideband you're sending out. In that particular case, you may have to call up your buddy who lives a mile away and tell him, play it back to me over the telephone. Let's see how I really sound on the air. In the case of an amplitude